Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky, sitting in for Denny Smithson. My guest is Gary Wills, noted historian, winner of Pulitzer Prize. Books include The Second Civil War, Nixon Agonistes, Inventing America, Confessions of a Conservative, Witches and Jesuits, several other books. This latest book, Negro President, Jefferson and the Slave Power, actually comes out of a book you're working on Henry Adams, is that correct?
That's right. Yes, I'm writing a book about the nine-volume history that Adams wrote in his 40s of the administrations of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, which has been almost totally neglected, and I think it's his great masterpiece. Most people see the end of his career as the peak of it, the education of Henry Adams, Mont Saint-Michel, Chartres, but I think those are in decline, and his great work was the middle period, and that's what I'm writing about.
When you're writing about American history, as opposed to writing about books on Catholicism, such as St. Augustine, or some of the other works you've written on other areas, how easy or hard is it to keep your own political perspective out of it, particularly when we're talking here about events that happened over 200 years ago?
Well, I don't see any reason to keep my own perspective out of it, after
all. Well, political perspective.
No, I don't see any reason to keep that out. You know, Acton was a great historian who said, the job of a historian is not to be objective. It's to be adequate, intelligent, and moral. He said, if you're writing about murderers, you should call them murderers. You shouldn't say, well, they had their values in their time, we have our values now. Some people have said about this book that I should not be so harsh on the slave institutions, because they were accepted by the people in their time. Well, so what? It was evil then, it's evil now.
The book talks about how the view of Jefferson as, yes, a great president, so on and so forth, but we have to understand that not merely was he a slaveholder, but through his political actions, encouraged and furthered slavery.
He owed, of course, his political existence as well as his economic maintenance to the institution of slavery. He was elected in 1800, not by free votes. John Adams got more of those than anyone, but because of the three-fifths clause in the Constitution that counted three-fifths of the slave population as belonging to the representation of the South. So he would have lost otherwise, but he had 12 votes given him free because of that. That's a good symbol of the fact that all of his life, he had to maintain slavery. All of the Southerners were living on a volcano, and they were panicky about criticisms of slavery, attacks on slavery, about the slaves themselves rising. It was impossible to have a political career in the South if you were critical of slavery. Some people say, why didn't Jefferson free his slaves? Well, first of all, he couldn't have economically. He was in debt. But if he had, it would have ended his career. He would have had no power. Same with Washington, same with Madison. None of the great Southern leaders freed their slaves except Washington after his death and hid the fact that he was going to do it before his death. You were not allowed to be a critic of slavery and have a political career. In fact, by the time of the 1820s and 1830s, you couldn't even discuss slavery in the South. Abolitionist literature was banned, outlawed, even though it came in under the U.S. mail. Abolitionists themselves were ridden out of town, tarred and feathered, beat. It was an institution that they were very nervous about, and they had to take every means to protect it, and Jefferson was especially good at that. He even said, toward the end of his life, when he was rushing to finish the University of Virginia, we've got to finish this university because our young Virginia men are going to Harvard and Princeton and Yale and learning restrictionism. He meant that the federal government has the right to restrict the spread of slavery into the territories, which Jefferson denied by then. He said, we've got to train people to defend the spread of the slavery into other territories. And, of course, he actually did spread it when he bought Louisiana. He tried to spread it when he tried to take over the Floridas and Cuba. He supported its spread in Missouri. He would have supported, if he had lived long enough, its spread into the conquered Mexico territories. So all through this time, he is defending, as he has to, his base. A good example of that is that when Toussaint Louverture had the rebellion in what we now call Haiti, The Adams administration, with Timothy Pickering as Secretary of State, had supported the revolution and had sent the United States Navy to support it. And the minute Jefferson came in, he cut that off as president. He succeeded Adams. And he told Napoleon's representative, if you want to come and crush Toussaint, we'll help you by starving him out.
You make a point, which is that they couldn't publicly criticize slavery. And I have a quote from you saying, of our first 15 presidents, only two actually did, which were the Adamses, and they were from the North.
Yes.
Do we have any indication that any of these 13 presidents were not racist, but actually just did it in order to maintain the power of the Republican Party or their own power?
Well, I don't know that it's very useful to try to decide exactly what kind of, what degree of racism any of them had, because the practical effect was the same. They felt they had an institution. Some felt it was evil, but a necessary evil that they had to support. In a way, of course, then as now, everybody was a racist. That is, even the northern abolitionists, most of them did not believe in the equality of the blacks. Most of them, early on at any rate, did not think that the blacks should have full equal rights, that they should vote, but they just thought they should not be enslaved. And they thought that not only in terms of their rights, but of the dignity of the slaveholders, that it was demeaning to own slaves. And many of them were really more concerned with the dignity of the whites than with the rights of the blacks. So it doesn't help very much to try to decide how racist Thomas Jefferson really was. He could talk to the French as an enlightened philosopher and say, well, we deplore the fact that we have slaves, and we plan to get rid of them eventually. On the other hand, he never did anything practical in that line. Certainly, there are equivocal things in his treatment of slaves. He did say that they had an equal moral sense with us, and he thought that was the most noble faculty in human beings. On the other hand, he thought they were intellectually inferior and lazy and ugly. He was an aesthete, and one of the things that offended him is, you know, he says in his most enlightened writing that it's impossible to show the soul when the veil of blackness makes it impossible for you to blush or blanch or that kind of thing. It's an abyss that's probably better not plumbed, and we can't sort out their merits in those terms. I think the only thing we can do is say that institutionally they were committed to not only protecting the slaves, but extending the realm of slavery. And that was what made it immoral in the eyes of critics in the North, whether they were partly racist themselves.
Gary Wills, to get kind of a perspective on this, let me ask you a couple of questions. Let's go back a little bit before Jefferson, because you don't really talk about it here, which is Benjamin Franklin. Now, we all, people who know about history kind of look at Franklin as the great American, the man who kind of put it all together. And then he was so old that he didn't continue because he died, you know. But he put it all together, and he was in league with Jefferson and with the Southern Republicans against Adams and the Federalists before there were really political parties. How did he view slavery?
Well, he didn't talk about it much. The best that you can get out of Franklin, it seems to me, is his attitude toward Native Americans, who were a real issue in Pennsylvania. And the Paxton boys and others out on the western frontier were very unjust to Native Americans, and he defended them beautifully. Now, I presume that he might have done the same for blacks if he felt that he had any say in the matter. He hardly ever talked about slavery, black slavery, and he was not quite as much a natural rights philosopher as Jefferson was. Jefferson had contradictions. Franklin was much more a pragmatist. How do you improve what you have, which is always incremental? And so it's very easy to find him on both sides of almost everything. You know, he came into the revolution very hesitantly and reluctantly because he had for years wanted to improve the colonial situation without dissolving the empire. So it's very hard to say what he would do. A more interesting case, really, is Washington, who had to defend slavery also. But he did change his mind. He became much more aware of the injustice of slavery as he went along. And he did free his slaves after his death, which is a difficult thing to do. Part of the whole slave institution was that they made it hard to free slaves. They didn't want them drifting around in the society. So in most states, the procedures varied, but they demanded that you get them out of the state if you're going to free them, or give them a guaranteed job, or employ them yourselves as a free labor, or give them some kind of pension that would support them so they're not. So Washington took the latter course, and even though most plantations ran in debt and it was hard to accumulate a capital investment, he did. He built up a fund for the slaves, and a very touching thing during one of the bicentennial exhibits, I saw the ledger at the Smithsonian in which the payments to his slaves were doled out, and it ran right into the 1830s. They were still paying these slaves Washington's money because he had arranged them for their being freed. He's about as enlightened as you get, except for a few people who didn't have a political career and actually freed their slaves and sent them into other states and that kind of thing. That was very unpopular, and there were a lot of pressures against it. As I say, the solidarity of the South on this issue was such that they outvoted the North even though they had a minority of the white population. Partly this was the Three-Fifths Clause, of course, which was essential to a whole series of votes. But partly it was the fact that they always, whenever that interest was touched, slavery, they all voted the same. And they didn't have the class divisions that the North did, that they might differ on and split the vote. A poor white felt privileged because he was white and felt the need of the plantation owners to protect his privilege and to keep him safe against slave insurrection. So that solidarity against the blacks created a tremendous camaraderie. And in a sense, some of the things we think of as Virginian and Southern virtues, their hospitality, their courtesy to each other, was part of the thing that they all belonged because they were white. And if you went to any person's house in Virginia and you were a Virginian, they'd have to take you in. Washington entertained hundreds and hundreds of people who just wandered in. And Jefferson resented that so much that he went off and built a second home which he could retire to so that he wouldn't be inundated with visitors.
You bring up some interesting points and concerning the North and South. And in your book, Gary Wills, Negro President, we learn all about how the North is basically mercantile and manufacturing. The South is agrarian. Obviously, in an agrarian society that survives on the basis of slavery, their entire culture, and I think you say it here, would have completely collapsed had slavery been outlawed in those days. But in talking about that, let's put that in the context of what became the great battle between two political parties in the early days of the Republic, which is the Federalists and the Republicans. When you're looking at who's on one side, who's on the other, you could see the difference, right? Except yeah. The slavery thing is kind of there doing other things. But when you're looking about the creation of the Constitution and you're putting aside the slavery, the agrarian, the mercantile, what were those differences between the parties?
Well, they were immense. They were religious. You know, the North was a dissenting religion in all of its branches, and the South was the established religion, the Anglican religion. They had a tie to England, commercial and otherwise, that was very close, whereas Jefferson and his followers had a tie to France. So in some ways, it was a war between Francophiles and Anglophiles. One believed in much more authoritative organization of society, both economic and Hamiltonian schemes, and privileged in terms of old families having more say than young families. There was privilege on both sides, of course, because this was the 18th century, it was a deferential society. But anyway, these were deep psychological, cultural, religious, economic differences that, in a way, made it impossible for them ever to get along until the Civil War finally allowed the North to prevail. So when you talked about a Federalist, not every Federalist had all of these qualities. You know, Hamilton, for instance, didn't have, well, he had some religious background, but it was not as important to him as to somebody like Adams. Economics was less important to Adams than to Hamilton. The tie to England was obviously less important with some people, but extremely important with others. And that was tied in with the fact that the carrying trade, the North had the Navy, had seamen, had commercial fleet, I should have said, rather than Navy. It was a seagoing culture. You know, they were whalers. They grew up with the sea. And England was their principal partner in that trade through the Caribbean. France didn't have much of a commercial fleet, and its navy was not anywhere near England's. So there was a kind of conflict that nobody recognized, that the South had to sell its cotton and its tobacco, its rice and indigo, and it had to have ships to carry that. And most of the ships that carried it, if they were not northern, were English. So even though they resented the English, especially since they carried great debts with them, the English were their creditors and resented for that, the two were really dependent on each other. The North had to have something to carry in the ships, and the South had to get the stuff out into the ships. But it was a partnership in which each resented the other. And there were guilty feelings on both sides, too. The North realized that, of course, they had traded in slaves. They had carried the slaves before they carried the tobacco. And so some of it was an attempt to rid themselves of their own guilt. And the South, of course, realized that they were dependent on the North. If the ships weren't there, the tobacco would rot on the wharf. So it's a very complicated clash of cultures in which they can't disengage from each other and they can't really be comfortable with either.
You're listening to an interview with Gary Wills, whose book is titled Negro President Jefferson and the Slave Power. The battle between the Republicans and the Federalists entered new territory, I guess, in 1800. It had always been there in an election which Jefferson became president, though it could have just as easily, I guess, been Aaron Burr.
Yes.
At that particular time, you posit that the main voice against Jefferson was a man named Timothy Pickering, somebody who, unless you're really a historian, you don't know who he is.
No, we've largely forgotten him, which is a little surprising. He was a Salem, Massachusetts, Puritan abolitionist farmer's son, and he was an abolitionist himself all of his life. He went to Harvard and picked up a kind of liberal religiosity, which separated him from his father, and he also joined the Revolution. His father remained a loyalist. He served in the militia. He served in Washington's army. He was appointed quartermaster general by the Congress. He was the postmaster general. He was the secretary of war. He was the secretary of state under Washington and Adams, and Adams fired him, and that's one reason why historians have not held him in high esteem. He supported the Alien and Sedition Laws, and he opposed Adams's coming to terms with France and ending the Quasi-War, as it was called. And because he was disloyal to his own president, Adams fired him. Then he went into Congress and spent 12 years in Congress attacking the Three-Fifths Clause. As I say, he was always against slavery, and he was one who really thought that the Three-Fifths Clause was at the basis of all the troubles.
Now, the Three-Fifths Clause specifically would be, let me see if I got it right here.
Okay,
you have a farmer in the South. Okay, that's one vote. Normally, you would think that a slave either would have a full vote as a citizen or no vote. But in fact, a slave had three-fifths. So, for instance, if he had 50 slaves, that meant that there were 30 votes if the slaves voted for themselves. But they didn't because they were slaves. So, in essence, that one man had 31 votes.
Exactly. Okay. And, of course, if he had 300, he had to have 500, he had to have 300 votes. And that's what the North, of course, said. Here am I. I'm a privileged Federalist property-holding man. I don't have more vote than the next person beside me in the country. And you down there have 31 votes, 40 votes, whatever. Why did the North let themselves get into that situation? Because the South would not have entered the constitutional framework without some kind of representation. They went to Philadelphia knowing that they were only about 40% of the population. And the cultural differences were so great then that they expected that if they were outnumbered, they would be endangered. Their institution would be endangered, especially. So they said, we won't come in until you, unless you count all of our slaves as part of our population, which would have made it about 50-50. And the North, of course, said, that's wrong. It rewards you for having slaves. It gives you an incentive to have more slaves. So, no, we can't do it. And they said, well, you have to do it or we won't come in. And they said, all right, then, we'll give you half. We'll count half of the population. And they said, no, that's not enough. And the South demanded 3/4. And the 3/5 number, that weird number, is a compromise between half and 3/4. And the North knew that they were building trouble for themselves. James Wilson and others had denounced that, but they finally said, our main job now is to create a union, and we'll try to fiddle with it afterward. We'll try to amend and change and all that. And, of course, once the South got that bone in its teeth, it would never give it up.
Now, the creation of Washington, D.C., usually when we hear about it, we hear, oh, it was put there because it's halfway twixt and tween. Well, in point of fact, it's not halfway twixt and tween. In fact, it was put deliberately in slave states. Question for you, Gary Wills, a historian. Is that fact well known among historians?
No, it's not. For a long time, Jefferson's version of how it happened was believed. He said that it was a bargain struck between Madison and Hamilton, that if Madison would support the centralization of debts under Hamilton's Treasury Department, which the South opposed, Hamilton would support moving the capital down onto the Potomac. And more recently, well, since Second World War, say, historians have realized that that story is not true, like some of other Jeffersons. And they've nibbled at it in this or that way. Only recently have a number of people begun to realize what was really at issue. They couldn't have the capital in free territory, because they had had an experience already that when they went to Philadelphia, when President Washington did, and the Secretary of State Jefferson, and Attorney General Edmund Randolph, they took their slaves with them because they couldn't live without them. And they were criticized. The slaves were encouraged to run away. The law said that if they kept a slave there for 6 months, it was free. It was a city that had abolished its own slavery, and it said, well, a transient can come through and have their slaves, but they can't keep them forever, so we'll give them 6 months. Washington had to shuttle his slaves back down to Mount Vernon and hide from them the fact that he was doing it. Actually, some of them saw through it, of course. We had 12 presidents who were slaveholders in our history, more than a quarter. That would never have happened if it had been in Philadelphia. And, of course, they didn't like having their moral credentials challenged. They wanted to move to a place where these credentials would never arise, this problem would not arise, where there would not be Quakers stirring up trouble, where there would not be a seaport where there's a lot of chance to slip away. So what Washington did, Jefferson and Madison said, we've got to turn it all over to Washington. They took it out of the hands of Congress. They took it out of the hands of the states in which the territory was going to be carved up, Virginia and Maryland. Washington had the commission from Congress to survey 10 square miles, but above a certain line. Deliberately, he went below that line and incorporated the city of Alexandria into the District of Columbia, where it stayed until 1846 when it was deeded back to Virginia. But in doing that, he incorporated a slave city, which was the real center of gravity of the district. You know, the only other town there was Georgetown, which is a little hamlet. But this was a flourishing slave city, and he made it part of the District of Columbia. And the District of Columbia continued to be a slave city and a slave trading city. There was a thriving slave market there. And the interesting thing is that it continued right until the 13th Amendment, which means that during the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln, whose Emancipation Proclamation applied only to the rebelling states, fought the war against slavery in a slave city. Slavery was there all through the Civil War. This is one of the many things where we just have blanked out the tremendous permeation of our whole history and society by slavery.
Negro president is an ironic title, and maybe yes. Not intentionally by Pickering, but by you.
Yes, it's in quotes. It's what Pickering called him after 1800. He said he's not a real president. He's a president because he owns Negroes. He said Negroes bore him into the Temple of Liberty on the slaves' shoulders. And the Federalists picked that up, and they referred always to the three-fifths vote as the Negro vote, and the congressmen who came in by virtue of it as Negro congressmen, and votes that were carried because of it as Negro votes.
When we see blacks in America today questioning the history of America, it sounds that the more we hear about what the history was, the more, in fact, that questioning strengthens, I think.
Oh, absolutely. We still have not faced up to the heritage of slavery. A good example of that is that a year and more ago in Philadelphia, they were digging to raise a new Constitutional Study Center, and they found the house where Washington's slaves lived when he came and set up the government. And here's the first president of our new republic, right across the way from where the Declaration of Independence was drafted and signed. And so the first instinct of the people was to cover this up. And when a protest arose, they said, well, we'll call it the servant's house, you know, that old euphemism from Monticello and Mount Vernon and Williamsburg. And again, only protests made them finally say, okay, it was slaves. We began our government with our first president in our first place of honor. You know, here we are, Liberty Bell, Constitution Hall, et cetera, with slaves. It was difficult to get people to face up to it then. And, of course, we hear all the time things like the Confederate flag is not stained by slavery. It stands for freedom and states' rights and all of that kind of thing. It stands for those things just about as much as a skull and crossbones would, flying that. There's a reluctance to realize how much our whole history was distorted. And, of course, the North had to go along with it in some measure. The Northern Republicans joined with the slaveholders. And Abraham Lincoln was quite right in the second inaugural when he said, this is a sin we have all committed and we have all had to pay for it. The only way we can really unite in a deep spiritual way is to admit that we are all guilty. And it's a very self-deluded person who says they are entirely free from the strains of racism in our national psyche.
Gary Wills, now are you getting back to your Henry Adams?
Yes, I am. That's going to be called In Search of Jefferson, because his history is an attempt to come to grips with Jefferson, which he does, I think, better than anybody. He saw the flaws, and he also saw the greatness.
You've been listening to an interview with Gary Wills, whose latest book is Negro President, Jefferson and the Slave Power. Denny Smithson returns next week in his regular time slot. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.